Good morning. Welcome to Asia Today with Jeffrey Bingham Mead. I'm so glad that you could join us today. We're coming to you and the world with the miracle of modern technology and the magic of 21st century broadcasting from the renowned studios of Radio 1490 WGCH Greenwich, Connecticut, USA, and WGCH.com anywhere via live streaming over the internet. Our goal is to contribute to global understanding, promote connections in the arts, culture, education, business, public policy, and international exchange, and create opportunities in the spirit of enduring exploration, friendship, and trust, with a focus on the Asia-Pacific region. We've got a great show for you, so without further delay, let's get started.
Coming up on today's show,
Qingming Festival, also known as Tomb Sweeping Festival on the solar calendar, is 1 week from today. We're featuring an encore educational conversation I had with Douglas Chong, director of the Hawaii Chinese History Center in Honolulu. Also, we're featuring an encore conversation I had in 2016 with Professor Franklin Ng. He is the professor of anthropology and Asian American studies at California State University, Fresno. Meeting at the Hawaii Heritage Center in Honolulu, Chinatown, you'll hear about the Asian American immigrant experience and Professor Ng's 40 years of work on Asian American studies programs.
Stay tuned. We'll be right back after these important messages.
Shows like Asia Today rely upon sponsors, advertisers, and underwriters who care about the programming experiences we provide. Private support is the lifeblood of our ability to connect you and our global audience across time zones and cultures. Our ongoing mission is to present listeners like you with discerning, in-depth, cross-cultural content that enlightens, educates, and expands our horizons. We've set up a GoFundMe campaign on Facebook and on RadioAsiaToday.blogspot.com. If you have something to say or announce to the world, radio is the most effective way to do it. We're in the business of helping you succeed.
Welcome to Conversations with Jeffrey Bingham Mead, your host.
Next Friday marks the date of the annual Qingming Festival on the lunar calendar. With us today is an old friend of this show, and that would be Mr. Douglas Chong. He is the director of the Hawaii Chinese History Center in Honolulu's Chinatown. He's with us today to discuss the cultural significance and to educate us about this very important Chinese tradition. Douglas, thank you very much for joining us today. What is the Qingming Festival?
Qingming is really a festival called the Bright and Clear Festival, and it's one of the most significant of the solar occasions that are celebrated in China. As you know, most of all the festivals center around the lunar calendar, but what people don't realize is that there are stems of the sun that are involved with the calendar. So you have the sun and the moon, both cycles running simultaneously. Many of the occasions dealing with the sun have to do with the agrarian calendar, meaning when to plant grain, when to harvest. All of these things follow the solar calendar. Qingming is one of the few of the solar calendar events that constantly is celebrated by the Chinese, majority of the Chinese, because it is really the largest festival which all the Chinese observe. It's that festival of the bright and clear, and it falls every year consistently on April 5th. Now, I'm talking Gregorian calendar, Western calendar, April 5th, because we live in a solar calendar.
Yes.
So therefore, it always happens on that date, except on leap year, when it falls a day earlier. But consistently, it is during the month of April that we celebrate this festival. This is an unusual festival because although it is the bright and clear festival, it deals a lot with the cult of the dead, in which many of the families observe what we call tomb sweeping customs. We go to the grave to sweep, to clean. In China, they're very superstitious about graves, and they would go to the graves not on Easter, on Christmas, on Valentine, on all these dates that the Western people go to the grave. They stay away from it because there's only two times a year that it's clean and that the higher spirits of the departed come back. And one is during Qingming, which is the solar festival, and the next is Chongyang, which is the ninth day of the ninth moon, and that is lunar calendar. So that varies every year. But that autumn festival is another time when Chinese go to the grave, spring and autumn. However, the autumn festival has really stopped being so popular, and it's only with the very old-time Chinese that still go to the graves to honor the dead.
Douglas, talk to us for a moment about the reverence that is attached to the Qingming Festival.
It's still one of the most revered of all the festivals because this festival has to do with filial piety, of one paying respects to the ancestors, of memorializing the ancestors. What better way in Chinese culture to honor those who have passed before us but by providing them with food, with drink, with money, with clothing, with all the earthly comforts that they were used to on earth. The idea being that once they are fed, their spirits are appeased, they rest happy. And when the departed rest happy, all the blessings flow forward to the living, to their descendants. There's nothing worse than having an ancestor lie in the grave forgotten. That is one of the epitome of filial piety, that we not only respect, but we honor the dead because they are living links to our lineage, to our past, to who we really are. And so even though a parent or a grandparent may have passed away, we have two festivals that, or two occasions that we still honor their spirits on the day that they were born or the day that they passed away. And then, of course, the general day of Qingming and the day of the autumn festival of Chongyong.
How is the holiday celebrated here in Hawaii?
Ever since the Chinese came to Hawaii, they would continue to go to the graves every Qingming festival during the month of April, anytime during the month of April, when the gates of the other world are open and the spirits come back. This is when the Chinese would come and would pay their respect with food, with drink, with firecrackers, with light, with incense, with mock money, clothing, and all of this would be presented to the ancestors in formalized Chinese memorial rituals. And these rituals are time-honored, and the way we have continued to do it in Hawaii is very, very traditional. Hawaii being a Joseon culture, entirely, almost, we still observe the style of the ritual and traditions that our ancestors brought with them over 200 years ago to Hawaii. So here we have 9th, 10th, 11th generation Chinese still going to the graves and honoring the departed exactly like their ancestors did 100 years ago. We don't find this very prevalent in most areas of China because of practices, because of the lack of having graves with bodies. Because we still have the graves, and because we still do it the same way that our fathers, grandfathers, grandmothers, great-grandfathers, great-great-grandmothers did it, this is one of the few places that you can still observe this. On April 5th, we will be having the community Qingming Festival. This falls one day after the opening of the festival on April 4th. On that day, the directors of the Cemetery Association has their own rituals to open up the gates. And the very next day, we have what we call the community Qingming observation take place up at the grand patio where the first ancestor was buried. We have a big, big festival with the Hawaiian singing, with the anthem, with the military, with the colors. We have flowers. We have all of these beautiful rituals which intertwine the not only the traditional Chinese ceremony, which is the ending of the whole festival, but also the welcoming ceremonies are very much integrated with what Hawaii is about, with American, with military, with Hawaiian, with finally Chinese. And then we end with the very ancient Chinese Qingming Festival, which is done in the traditional manner of burning of the firecrackers in front of the grand ancestor's tomb, we have the elaborate set of food, of five kinds of food, five bowls of rice, five cups of tea, five cups of wine, a whole roast pig, gold and silver, mock ingots, clothing, and all of these things. Following the traditional ceremonies, bit by bit, we would go through the ceremonies very formally, exactly the way that we families do it at the graves. After that, firecrackers are burned, not to scare away the evil spirits, but in the beginning, it's burned to welcome and to open the ceremony. And then at the end, it is to end the ceremony and to send the spirits to ascend back to their abode.
You're listening to Asia Today with Jeffrey Bingham Mead on Radio 1490 WGCH, Greenwich, Connecticut, USA, and WGCH.com anywhere via live audio streaming.
The ceremony itself lasts for several hours. At the end, we have a community luncheon that is served to all of the participants.
Who sponsors the festival?
The sponsors of this festival is spearheaded by the United Chinese Society, but it is really put together by the Hawaii Qingming Celebration Committee, which was formulated to perpetuate this community celebration. All the different Chinese societies are invited to donate funds and to participate and to be a part of this celebration. All of these Chinese organizations, and we have over 150 Chinese organizations in Hawaii itself, even though we command only 7% of the population, we have a lot of different clubs and organizations, they would donate some money, and they now come to become a part of the ceremonies. Every year we invite one token member of one society to be the token representative from the different Chinese clubs. The officiating ceremony participants or those who conduct the rituals are drawn from different organizations. We have represented people from the Chinese, United Chinese Society, from the different organizations in the formal lineup, right, and taking place in Chinese costume of the ceremony itself. After the whole ceremony is over, what we do is we pass out incense sticks to all the participants, and then we have a short community observance in which everyone is invited to burn incense and offer incense to the spirits before the closing of the whole ceremony. So this participation is wonderful because we have beauty queens from our different Chinese societies that have run in the Narcissus and the Chinatown beauty pageants. Mm-hmm. We have princesses, we have community leaders, we have many of the representatives from our city and county because they're one of the sponsors. We have a featured singer, Misty Kela'i, who has been with the city and county and who comes and sings the Hawaiian anthem as well as the national anthem. We have the colored guards, we have the military, and we even fly these beautiful colored pigeons at a certain part of the ceremony to send the spirits back to heaven. Wow. Yeah, so it's a very beautiful practice. Many of the leaders who began this community festival have passed away, but the descendants still carry on.
As we start to close, Douglas, what about the future of the Qingming Festival? What about future generations? What have you to say about that?
How long we're going to do it? As long as we possibly can. Hopefully, we will get to bring in the younger generation, because many of the whole ceremony, especially the Chinese part, is really conducted by myself and the elders who were brought up with not only the culture of conducting this memorial, but also knowing the Chinese language and practices so that we could carry it out. So bringing in younger people would not only entail recruiting younger people to do. You know, one thing is to just go through the motions. But as an educator for over 40 years, my objective is that the younger people must learn the language, the culture, the practices, and know what every single step of the ceremony is all about. Otherwise, there is no meaning to it. To go through a practice that blindly and And not knowing what you're doing or why you're doing it is senseless. So what we really want to do academically is to not only pass on the rituals and the practices, but that the younger people know exactly what they're doing, why they're doing it, and then to do it in the flavor, the language, and the whole nuance of how it was actually done.
My first guest today has been Douglas Chong, head of the Hawaii Chinese History Center in Honolulu's Chinatown. Douglas, as always, thank you for sharing your wealth of knowledge about the annual Jingming Festival, slated to take place next Friday on the 5th of April. This is Asia Today with Jeffrey Bingham Mead on Radio 1490 WGCH.com anywhere, and now on 105.5 FM, Stamford, Connecticut, USA. Franklin Ng is a professor of anthropology and Asian American studies at California State University, Fresno. He is the editor of the Asian American Encyclopedia, the author of Taiwanese Americans, and the co-author of Asian American Issues. He is also the editor of the Routledge series, Studies in Asian Americans, Reconceptualizing Culture, History, and Politics. Professor Ng's areas of specialization include Asian American Studies, East Asian Studies, Cultural Anthropology, American East Asian Relations, and International History. From 2004 to 2006, Ng served as president of the Association of Asian American Studies. He currently serves on the editorial board of AmerAsia Journal, the Journal of American Ethnic History and Chinese America, History and Perspectives, and was the former editor of the Journal of American East Asian Relations. I recently met with Franklin Ng at the Hawaii Heritage Center in the heart of Honolulu's Chinatown. The center is a nonprofit organization that educates the public about the rich and diverse history of the Hawaiian Islands. It offers walking tours, workshops, and public exhibits. My special thanks and sincerest aloha goes to Ms. Karen Motosue, director of the center, for introducing us. Surrounded by an impressive cultural gallery and artifacts on display, I was curious to learn about the Asian American immigrant experience and Professor Ng's 40 years of work on Asian American studies programs. Why such programs are or should be viable?
Well, the thing is that they're viable primarily because of the fact that they differentiate between Asians in the United States and Asians in Asia.
Right.
For a long time, there was a tendency to overlook the Asians in the United States. But today, the interface between Asians in the United States and Asians in Asia is becoming ever more close, intimate, because of globalization, transnationalism, and so on. So the thing is that Asian American studies actually is a very rich field to explore. Many of the early Asian immigrants to the United States, for example, went back and helped in terms of the modernization of China, Japan, Korea, and other places. They were actually agents for nationalism because they saw what a united nation could do in terms of the power of Europe and nations in Europe, as well as the nations, in North America.
Right.
And when they looked at the weakness of Asian nations, they sort of felt that we need to change our homelands. So in the same way that Italian immigrants actually helped to unify Italy, it's the case that Chinese who immigrated to North America, Canada, and the United States, they also became agents for the Chinese Revolution under Sun Yat-sen.
Oh, yes.
Because they could see the benefits of industrialization, the incorporation of new ideas, the idea of political reform. So the thing is that thinking about Asians in the United States or North America, think of them as people who actually harbored new ideas that could change their homeland. So that this is a very interesting interface that I think we shouldn't neglect. Asians also wanted to, in the United States, wanted to actually make the American public aware of the fact that there had been Asians who had helped to create America.
Yes.
That they had helped to actually transform the American West. But in terms of the writing of American history, this facet tended to be neglected because people focused more on the Atlantic connection.
Yes.
But actually, the United States is a country that fronting on two oceans, the Atlantic and the Pacific. And so we oftentimes tend to forget the Pacific heritage.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine, John C. Whitehead, who used to teach at the University of Alaska, would say that relating to Hawaii, Hawaii was the first and the last frontier because really even before there were major settlements in California, people were coming to Hawaii in the Middle Pacific.
That is true.
And yet it was also the last frontier because Hawaii became the 50th state.
Yes.
So the thing is, Hawaii is both the sort of first and the last frontier because even before California had settlements, Hawaii already had seamen who were whaling, who were making ties with the China trade and so on. So it's a very fascinating history. In fact, Hawaii becomes very difficult when you talk about American history because you always wonder, when do you bring it in? After 1959 or after annexation, after the Spanish American? But Hawaii was always a place where American missionaries, merchants, and others came in during the 18th century.
Right.
So it's a very tricky thing in terms of how you incorporate into American history, Hawaii. Right.
I was reading The History and Immigration of Asian Americans, edited by Professor Ng. An article he penned titled, The Sojourner, Return, Immigration, and Immigration History caught my eye with something called the Sojourner Hypothesis.
Well, it means that people came to America and they wanted to return back to their homeland. And in the 40s and 50s, even into the 60s and 70s, this was oftentimes a stigma on Chinese immigrants because the idea was that they came to America to make their fortune, but then they wanted to take their wealth and go back to their homeland. That meant that they actually were not invested in the United States, and that therefore they were actually sort of like gold diggers here to make their money and then to take it back and actually not actually making any major investment in the nation that had been so hospitable to them. Now, in the 1960s and 1970s, when you had the beginnings of Asian American studies, many of the activists and scholars involved in this wanted to claim America. Right. So they said that Chinese came to stay. But the historical record shows that Chinese immigrants actually went back. My argument in terms of my article on the Sojourner Hypothesis was that what the Chinese did was no different than what European immigrants were doing. It had been the case that most historians thought that European immigrants came to stay, whereas the Chinese immigrants went back. But actually, it turned out, in terms of the new social history that was being written in the 70s and 80s, that immigrants who came from Italy, Greece, Poland, Ireland, England, they all went back in large numbers because if you think about immigrants as people, they harbor sentiments about their parents, their brothers, their siblings, their cousins. And many of them wanted to be buried in the family sort of churchyard. So the thing was that those kinds of, let's say, sentiments that made the homeland so dear to the Chinese were actually to be found in European immigrants. So what I was saying was that it was not only the Chinese who were sojourners, it was actually European immigrants who were sojourners. But World War I changed that for European immigrants.
Oh, yes, that's true.
So after that, not so many people went back to their homeland.
Angel Island was a contrast. I asked Professor Ng to elaborate.
Ellis Island in New York, also claimed by actually New Jersey, was actually considered to be the sort of point of entry for immigrants from across the Atlantic. Many people claim that Angel Island, not too far from Alcatraz, is the entry point for immigrants from across the Pacific. So Chinese immigrants, Japanese immigrants, Korean immigrants, South Asian immigrants, and others, Germans from Russia, they also came in through Angel Island. But Angel Island was primarily a place to quarantine and to actually question whether those people would be eligible to enter in America. There tended to be a harshness at Angel Island, which was different than Ellis Island. It was not a welcoming place, and people could be forced to stay there for as long as 6 months to 2 years. So, but in terms of, let's say, many people, they tend to think of it as the Ellis Island of the West. But actually, it was more like a prison in the West.
Yes.
Okay. But interesting story about Ellis Island and Angel Island. My son, on Columbus Day, was asked by his teacher, so where did your parents or grandparents come in through? Was it Ellis Island or Angel Island? And my son said, neither. He came through Honolulu. And it shows that Hawaii is out of sight, out of mind, like in the weather reports. You never see Hawaii. You never see Alaska. You only see the other lower 48.
I noted that Professor Ng asked a very thought-provoking question. Quote, how is it that the accomplishments of Asian Americans in building railroads, developing agricultural landscapes across the nation, fighting in wars involving the United States, and contributing to the success of the American nation are ignored or forgotten? Unquote. So I asked, obviously, what's the answer?
Well, my thing is that history is the record written by people who actually assign priorities to certain things.
Yes.
And you might say it's because of Puritan history and so on, that it tended to be for a long time sort of, let's say, anchored in the East. Today we have more regional histories, so that people are actually trying to say what's, for example, I know among colonial historians, they say that in some ways the Chesapeake was more important than Boston in terms of the colonial history of the early Republic, of even prior to the Republic. And I think what's happened is because of recent immigration in the 60s and 70s, and the decades since then, people are having more of a Pacific perspective because of the importance of the Asian nations. I think a person like Maya Lin, this young girl who in 1981 had designed for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, shocked American memory, because how was it that this young Chinese girl that was in the age of 21 suddenly was able to design a monument that could actually commemorate the sacrifices of veterans who had served in America. And many people said, who is this person? Is she Vietnamese? Showing that they didn't know the difference between Chinese and Vietnamese. Is the fact that she wears black clothes, that the pajamas of the Viet Cong. What does a woman know about warfare? Can a woman even know about the sacrifices of men? So it showed all the different kinds of, let's say, currents in popular thinking. But this young girl of 21 was able to make a sort of a monument, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, that was formed in 1982, that became the most visited monument in Washington, D.C. So the things that is, let's say, changes in thought are incremental, but we have to also recognize that they're emotive screams. For example, if they teach the history of the South in Southern universities or Southern schools, do they emphasize the legacy of slavery, or they talk about states' rights? And the thing is that that shows you that there can be a sort of an emotive screen that sort of dictates how you interpret the facts. So the thing is that people go by these interpretations, which usually have, let's say, sentiment, emotions. You might say you call it social memory or cultural memory, but there are these actually emotive elements in terms of how people think about the past and how they write about the past. And so that because the Chinese did not and Asians did not figure very strongly in terms of how people thought, maybe because of their social circles and so on, they tended to exclude the contributions of Asians in the past.
And that is changing.
That's changing.
My final question focused on an issue I hear often from Chinese American community leaders. I asked Professor Ring for his thoughts on the task of passing on traditions from one generation to another.
Well, it's hard to claim an easy solution for this because Americans have tended to be forward-looking in many respects. And I think it was Ford that said history is bunk or something like this. they don't tend to oftentimes think in terms of the richness of the national experience or even the regional experience. So I would say that you have much to learn by taking a look backward, even as you also at the same time keep your eyes looking forward. And the thing is that the Asian American past, the Chinese American experience, is constantly being transformed because nowadays we have, for example, Chinese coming from Taiwan, we have Chinese coming from Fuzhou, we have Chinese coming from other regions. And for example, like in New York City, where you're anchored sometimes, you notice that the restaurants are actually quite diverse. It's no longer the Cantonese variety. So what you call the Chinese American experience is sort of, let's say, rewriting it. It's constantly in turmoil and in transformation. So the thing is that the past that people think of as being simple and easy might actually be much more complex as we have new wrinkles in terms of the Chinese-American experience.
Thank you for tuning in to today's Asia Today show with Jeffrey Bingham Mead, broadcasting to all four corners of the world from Radio 1490 WGCH, Greenwich, Connecticut, USA, and from WGCH.com anywhere via live global streaming over the internet. We'll be back next Saturday morning starting 10:30 a.m. Eastern Time. See you then.